Hello, everybody, and welcome to minute 96 of season 5 of the Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me, my recurring guest who likes to take over when someone for some reason can't make it to record. So I want to welcome back my good buddy Alan Sanders from the now defunct and hopefully at some point revived Wilder Ride. Welcome back, Alan.
Thanks a lot, Rob. No, I like to think of myself as your permanent go-to bench talent, that when something something happens, whether somebody has to drop out or somebody has a conflict, that you can always reach out to the bench, and I just need a couple of warm-up swings, and then I'm good to go.
That's right. You're always the first guy off the bench, so there you go. You got that. All right. So first of all, thank you for showing up at the relatively last minute. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, this may be the fastest you've ever gotten me to commit and then actually start recording.
No, I think I told you like 2 weeks ago. It's been a while. So, for us, that's a long time. Yeah. You know,
so. Normally it's 2 months. I figure a way to kind of push it back, but okay.
No, well, yeah, you didn't have to show up. You know, you wanted to.
No. So. I wanted to. Oh my gosh! And especially when you said, "By the way, it's a pretty good week." I'm like, "Oh, okay. Well, Die Hard 2. Are there any bad weeks? But some weeks do stand out."
Yes, this is one that will slightly stand out. But we'll get there. We'll get there as the week goes by.
I can tell you this because I saw this in the movie. I saw it in the theater. I think we talked about this when I was first on. There's going to be moments this week that still I'll remember what it was like the first time seeing it, because I was hit not once, but twice in the minutes coming up where I didn't see it coming. And I still remember that shock of like, how did I miss that?
Exactly. That's what this movie is all about. And, you know, it happens pretty much entirely in this week. So, you know, that worked out well for you. Mm-hmm. You know. All right, so minute 96 begins with Telford getting ribbed by his comrades and ends with a lone figure appearing on the top of the stairs. So we finished on Friday with the snowmobile chase and John figuring something out. You know, we're not 100% sure what he finds out. I mean, the script did tell us, but, you know, in the movie itself, they for some reason decided not to tell us. I haven't figured that one out yet. Why, you know, I guess visually it's more of a problem to do it. Maybe mm-hmm. that's what it comes down to, you know.
Without giving anything away for our listeners for this coming week, I had no idea what the problem was, only that he made a comment about he was right in my sights, and then he looks down and you realize he's put two and two together, but we're like, what did you figure out? And we don't know.
That's right. That's right. We do not know what he found out. And I like the way that they do it in the end, because, you know, it gives us a little bit of a surprise as to what's going to happen later this week, mm-hmm. even though we're going to go very much into detail about why that is completely impossible. But that's a separate issue. We'll get there. We'll get there. We're not going to jump ahead for that one. So basically, all the guys from Blue Light get back into the truck. You know, last week we had Grant give out all these crazy orders about, you know, how they have to be ready and they're gonna have a full assault and all that stuff. And, you know, we just see the guys riding around in the back of the truck, or actually I don't even know if they've started moving, but they're in the back of the truck. And one of the guys, we never even find out who says this, because all these Blue Light guys don't have names. You know, you have Grant, you have Telford, and then you have the rest of them. You know, even in IMDb, you have some of them just listed as Blue Light, and the other ones are listed as First Sergeant, Second Sergeant, things like that.
It's certainly moving, because even though it's just a split second here, the truck is going across the field, and then once we cut inside, they've got that actor shake, you know, like you just kind of pretend like we're all bouncing along.
Right. And then one of the guys, like I said, we don't really know who it is particularly. He goes, "Hey, Telford, what was your chick outfit doing while we were taking Grenada, however you want to pronounce that?" You know, and okay, so first of all, I've mentioned this before, but do you know who the actor is who plays Telford? Are you familiar with who it is?
I'm looking at his face right now, and I could not tell you at all. There's no dawning recognition for me.
Okay, I mean, I don't know if it's a question of you recognizing, you know, he never really had a major acting career, but what was the most prominent, what is the most prominent thing about him is he is Mr. Rebecca De Mornay.
Married to Rebecca De Mornay, huh?
Yes, they have two kids together. So, you know,
there's a name. Is it Patrick something?
Yes, Patrick O'Neill.
O'Neill. Okay, yeah, I know the name.
Oh, you've heard it before?
Is he a sports guy? A sports something? I can't remember.
I actually, you know what? I think he is. I think he's a sports. I think he was a sports announcer for a little while.
A sports cast or something.
Yeah, I think there was something to that. He was in very few movies.
He
has 14 acting credits. You know, that's it. But I think he was a football guy. I think I did mention this at some when we talked about him a few weeks ago. That he was on the TV series Totally Football.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. The only reason I know of the name is when you brought up Rebecca De Mornay. That was it. I would have had no knowledge about anything about him until you said that. So that was the big reveal for me.
Mm. Great. Okay. He was a sportscaster for Fox Sports. That's what it is.
Okay.
You know. So yeah. I mean that's his. For me, it's just really funny just seeing him here. He's this like babyface guy, and at the same time that this movie was being made or around the same time. I mean, think about the movies that Rebecca De Mornay was in. I mean, they weren't married yet. They only got together a few years later, but still. And he's also, he's the son of Ryan O'Neill.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so he's, I guess, part of the Hollywood elite, I guess you can sort of say.
It gets your foot in the door, we can say.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, he's a half brother of Tatum O'Neill and Griffin O'Neill. And Redmond O'Neill, and his mother is Lee Taylor Young, you know. So he's, you know, but he definitely is baby faced here and fits in. Mm-hmm. He fits in really well as this character, you know, who is somewhat of a red herring basically, because mm-hmm. you know we don't know, you know, we're told earlier that there was a last minute change in personnel, but we don't know who they're talking about, and you know, and then he mentions at some point that, you know, he's just there because, you know, the regular guy got appendicitis, mm-hmm. you know, so they're sort of giving us these little hints to something, but we're not really sure what it is. So they mentioned some great things in the first, you know, in the first volley of dialogue here. First of all, you know, he says your chicken outfit. So what do you know about the term chicken?
Ironically, having chickens.
So you deal a lot with chickens.
I deal with the actual droppings, which by the way are great fertilizer. But it's always been a term used to mean someone's a coward or somebody found ways to avoid conflict or avoid fights. They're a coward. You're a chicken, but it's like chicken on steroids. You're not just chicken like Marty McFly. You're chicken shit.
Right, that's right. And what's really interesting is that it's one word. You know, it's not chicken sh**, it's chicken.
Right. Chicken sh** is something different than being a chicken.
That's correct. That's chicken manure.
Right.
Yes. But so there's basically two different definitions of the term chicken. First one is someone who is petty or insignificant, and the other one is lacking courage, manliness, or effectiveness. That's more or less the one that we were, you know, referring to here with the whole thing. So, you know, as the term being used as a coward, how far back do you think that term goes, where you would call someone a chicken?
It's been my whole life, so it's got to be a while. I have no idea when it was first used. I don't know the etymology, but I know I've known that my whole life. So well over half.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's a lot more than that. It's almost a century old. It was first noted as being used in 1929 to, you know, to refer to someone who's being cowardice.
Hmm. Right after right
you can use
the,
it
the fall of the stock market, start of the Great Depression.
That's right.
Interesting.
And it can either be a noun or an adjective, but it is always an insult.
No, it's never used fun.
Yeah.
One of the other times, and ironically, it's almost the exact same line, but used differently in the movie Aliens, is when Hudson says, "How do I get out of this chicken shit outfit?"
That's right. And, you know, that's 4 years before this movie came out. So, you know, so you can't even say that one copied the other, because I don't think D'Souza, you know, looked at the script of Aliens to try and help him figure out what he wants to give the characters.
This would be a typical military ribbing. You assume your unit is the brave unit, and somebody else that didn't do anything, they got assigned to the chicken unit. So, I mean, I think that's just a military euphemism, and it works very well in this, obviously, setting, because we've got these guys have been established as, you know, high-end military commando types.
Right. That's true. And then Petty, so the idea of calling someone you know, either petty or insignificant nonsense, it can also be used as either a noun or an adjective. And it basically is the scent, and it comes from the military. Chicken refers to behavior that makes military life worse than it needs to be. Petty harassment of the weak by the strong, open scrimmage for power and authority and prestige, sadism thinly disguised as necessary discipline, a constant paying off of old scores, an insistence on the letter rather than the spirit of the ordinances. Chicken is so-called instead of horse or bull or elf because it is small-minded and takes the trivial seriously. So, I mean, that's an interesting way to look at it. You know, that thinking about the size of the animal, and based on that, you know, because it's chicken, so it's a much smaller and petty, small-mindedness. So, yeah, I like that. There's also a very famous phrase. I've never heard this before, but it says, "You can't make chicken salad out of chicken."
No.
I mean, that expression goes back to the 1920s, and Lyndon Johnson is actually quoted as once having saying, "I may not know much, but I do know the difference between chicken and chicken salad."
Yeah.
And everyone who knows anything about Lyndon Johnson knows that he was not somebody who minced words. He, one of the presidents who was known for his vulgarity and for the way that, you know,
he spoke. Let's put it this way. If you didn't know the difference, it's only going to be a mistake you make once.
That's true. That's very true.
This doesn't taste like chicken salad at all.
Now, I mean, what I find really interesting is the fact that you know, I've been in the military. You've been in the military. Usually when you need a replacement for someone in your unit, you know, you're going to have somebody else who already knows how to do that job. You know, the idea of redundancy, the idea of a backup. I mean, I recently rewatched the movie We Were Warriors. We Were Soldiers, sorry. Yeah. But with Mel Gibson. Great. We Were Soldiers. Yeah, it was amazing rewatching it. One of these days I would love to read the book that's based on, but probably never get to that. That's why I just, you know, I have my cliff notes of movies instead of reading books. So, I mean, basically the, one of the things that they talk about in the movie is when they're training, you know, the idea is that everybody needs to learn the job of their immediate, the person right in front of them. So that if that person gets killed or wounded or whatever it is, you can take over their job. So I just find it really strange. I mean, besides as a plot point, that they would bring an outsider into this, as opposed to just saying, okay, you know, there's got to be someone else who can use the radio here.
You know, when you look at it from, like you're saying, a true logistics standpoint and manpower standpoint, it is a weak plot point. Most general audiences aren't even going to think anything about it. They're going to think like, oh, okay, there's this pool of people, like the military version of the temp agency. You just call in and say, can you send somebody in here who's got the following skills? We need them for a couple of days.
Well, a great example of that is Saving Private Ryan, you know, where they get Oppum because they need somebody who speaks German, you know. So, you know, they get him from a pool. They get him from the secretarial pool, mm-hmm. basically.
That's a little different than this. You know, this is a special ops unit that probably used to working together, training together, where you'd want to make sure that anybody knew you brought in, you wouldn't bring them in at the start of an operation. You'd bring them in to train for a long time to make sure that they'd mesh with what you need. But from an audience perspective, and I will tell you, of course, watching this movie when I was in my 20s, early 20s, you don't think about that. It just makes sense to you. Okay, they needed a backup. And as you mentioned, a pseudo red herring. Is he something more than he is?
Correct. You know, so yeah, no, I completely understand why they do this. But, you know, I'm just, I like looking at some things from a genuine perspective. And in a genuine perspective, this is probably not what would have happened.
Right. No, I agree.
You know. If
we were working in a mess hall and they needed somebody to come in and peel potatoes, sure, you're just going to pull somebody in. Not in this particular instance.
That's right.
This is too high. This is too far up the specialization chain that you wouldn't just bring somebody in that you didn't even know who he was.
That's right.
At the very
least. That's right. Especially when you look at what they're going to be doing with this guy.
Well, at the very least, what I was going to say is any of these guys, because they all have that camaraderie of shared combat. If let's say this guy had been in a similar, but let's say, side unit with another branch, somebody would have had combat time or combat experience with that person to have gotten the recommendation to say, hey, we've got an opening. I know a guy that I went, you know, two tours with in this theater or this operation. Let's see if we can bring him over, right? It's not going to be somebody that nobody knows.
That's right. Or, you know, the guy in the next platoon, you know, because I'm assuming that blue light is that they probably have a backup blue light, you know. They probably have guys that are, you know, that train with them. You know, even if you just want to use the analogy of space travel, you know, you always have the backup crew. Mm-hmm. That there's going to be someone else who you can use as a replacement if you need to. But it doesn't sound like that's what Telford, it sounds the way that he's ribbing him here basically makes it sound like he came from all the way out in left field. You know, this is a guy we've never dealt with before, you know. So, what can you do? That's what the plot needs.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately,
what the plot needs, the plot gets. Right. So, and then they mention Grenada, however you want to pronounce that. So, what do you know about that place? What can you tell me?
I do know Clint Eastwood made a movie about it.
Do you remember the name of the movie?
Hold on. Because the whole movie is about training people to go, and then the last 20 minutes is maybe seeing any kind of combat. It is...
That's right.
Oh, my God.
Go with your heart. Go with your heart.
It's on the tip of my tongue, dude. This is embarrassing. I know what it is. It's... I can't remember. something.
Well, the Marine Movie Minute did the movie minute by minute. You know, friend, you were on it. Oh, that's even worse. Right.
It's hold on.
Shout out to Brian.
Okay. Heartbreak Ridge. Jesus, I knew it was a
that's
ridge.
That's right. There
Heartbreak
you go.
Ridge.
Yes, Heartbreak Ridge.
My God, that should not have come. I gotta stop. Aging, something's gonna have to slow down. I need to stop getting a little bit older. That should not happen. But Heartbreak Ridge.
Yes. So Heartbreak Ridge. So do you know what happened in Grenada?
Wasn't it
do you know the story of what happened? Of
communist or some kind of rebels captured a bunch of students or put a bunch of American students in harm's way, something like that.
Well, basically there was a coup there. Mm-hmm. Grenada is a small little Caribbean island, basically 100 miles north of Venezuela. And basically on the 25th of October, 1983, the U.S. went and invaded this little country or this little island at dawn, because basically, and it was known as Operation Urgent Fury.
Mm.
And they basically occupied the country just for a few days, and there was an attempted coup, which they executed the previous leader and the second prime minister of Grenada, whose name was Morris Bishop, and they basically established a revolutionary military council. And basically, the idea was that the Americans went in because there was an American medical school that was there.
I knew that there was
And
something.
they
I know this was during the Reagan years, and I remember something about university students or something to do with there were Americans there. So by de facto, the U.S. military was mobilized.
Yes. Yes. And the invasion actually took place 2 days after the U.S. Marine barracks bombing in Beirut, which also goes to show, the way that the U.S. military was, mobilized globally at the time, and they were still reeling from this huge bombing. So, yeah, that's just completely crazy with the whole thing. It was a relatively short occupation, short I mean when you bring in the US Army to go take care of it. So, it's not as if you can say that they were fighting against
No.
a comparable
They
army.
were not comparable forces, not at all.
No. I mean, I have a list here of all the different units that were sent in. I mean, they sent like the top units to go take over stuff like that. I mean, there were thousands of troops that were sent there, but they basically took it over very quickly. And I mean, the number of casualties was more than one would think, but obviously not as large as some of the other thing. I mean, basically, first of all, Norman Schwarzkopf was the deputy commander of the invasion force, and they killed 160 Grenadian soldiers, 71 Cubans. The Pentagon's count was much lower, so I don't know who to really believe here, but they claimed that they found mass graves and things like that. So there's a lot of controversy, over the years as to what exactly what happened there and how many people they ended up killing and stuff like that. They had 8,000 US troops that participated in it, and there were 19 American soldiers that were killed and 116 wounded ones. So like we said, you can go watch Heartbreak Ridge if you want to see what quickly happens there.
Yeah, I'm going to spend 2 hours of the movie watching them train for the mission, and you get the last.
No, well, they weren't training for
Well,
them. They weren't
training
training
to
for that
be
mission. They
a
were
Marine.
training in
Right.
general. Yeah, training to be Marines, and then you got our good friend Clint to go to take them in. So after this comment is made, everyone starts laughing basically, and then Grant chimes in and goes, "Grenado, 5 minutes of firefight, 5 weeks of surfing." It's really interesting if you watch what he's doing. He seems to be passing something along. Could you tell
Yeah,
what
it's
he's passing
sticks
along
of
here?
gum. They're just gum. It's gum.
That's right.
Just
That's right. Were you able to tell what brand gum that is?
it looks a lot like the Double Mint style gum, but I don't know. Or extra.
It's close. You're close. You're very close. You're in the family.
Wrigley.
It's in the
It's
Double Mint
Wrigley
family.
something.
Yes. It's Big Red.
Is it?
Yes.
All right, because it looked like it
Yeah.
was a pink
It's the,
label. I didn't think it was a red label, but hey. I can't tell. Maybe my screen isn't colorblind.
to me it looked to me it looked like it was Big Red. I mean, we talked about Big Red in Die Hard 1, but I'll just mention what it is again. Do you remember what Big Red is? Like the flavor
Yeah,
of
it's
Big
cinnamon.
Red? Yes, the cinnamon flavored, and the whole idea of the campaign behind it is that the flavor lasts for a very long time. So they had the Big Red song. I remember those commercials that they would have, where they would say, kiss a little
Yeah,
longer.
romance a little longer.
That's right. You'd always have like somebody having to like I think they're one of the things is someone like misses a train and starts running after the train because he's kissing his girlfriend. He's kissing her goodbye, and then the train leaves because they're enjoying the cinnamon flavor, I guess a little too much or whatever. In the movie Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby, there's he does like a commercial and he goes, "I'm Ricky Bobby. If you don't chew Big Red, then f you." So.
Yeah. I used to love Big Red because the flavor, ironically, that cinnamon did last, it seemed like a lot longer than other flavors. Mint would last a while. Bubblegum never lasted
Yeah.
long enough. The bubblegum flavor, and especially as a kid, all I wanted was bubblegum flavor. But when I got a little bit older
That's right.
and started going out with the ladies, Big Red became my gum of choice.
There you go. That works. So he's passing out the gum, and then Telfer goes, "I wish I was with you guys for that." And Grant turns to him, "Yeah, me too, kid." And he goes, "Really, sir?" And he goes, "Sure. Then we wouldn't have to do this." And he very swiftly pulls out his survival knife and just slashes his throat. Very smoothly, nonchalantly, stuff like that. Now, why does he say then we wouldn't have to do this? Meaning, he's the one who's doing it. I mean, obviously they're all part of the plan, but the idea is that this is a guy who can't move on. We're at the point of no return. We got to get rid of you.
You know what's amazing? First of all, okay, let me just give my initial reaction. Even watching it now, I'm transported to that moment of just shock. Just, I've taken completely, did not see it coming, did not know it was coming. I feel just like this kid, like, doesn't even know what's happened. What I also think is amazing is now that we can slow this down, the rehearsal of him having the prosthetic already in his neck, and he's got to lean down just enough because the knife is going to roll over it, and as he opens his head back just a little bit, it splits open. So the wound
Right.
is already there, but because of the edit and how fast this works, it becomes a seamless, and it looks like he just completely goes right through his voice box. He's not going to be able to scream. He's not going to be able to talk. He's not going to be able to say anything. He's just going to sit there in shock, and I'm still watching it now for the 100th time this movie I've seen, it still is just as shocking to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's done so well also because if you when you're paying attention to these things, you see the way that Grant his eyes dart back and forth beforehand, looking at everyone, basically getting confirmation, via his eyes from everyone else that I'm about to get rid of this guy.
Yeah. And
We've moved into the next
that's the part
stage.
that gets you too, is you sit there because they've got the cutaway shot and they're all looking at him like, yeah, had to get rid of him. Like he's no more important to them than if you had squashed a bug.
That's right. That's right. They have absolutely no emotional feelings about the fact that they're, killing Telford.
Right.
This is, it's the next stage of the plan. That's all it is.
And it gives you a sense of some of these guys, just how cold and calculating and what they've probably been through doesn't even affect them. They're gonna gut this poor kid. They're gonna, basically just watch him bleed to death from his neck. And they don't even, it's like, well, part of the mission.
That's right. So I decided I was going to do a little research about slitting one's throat.
Oh, good. We haven't had a good gouting discussion in a while.
There you go. There you go. So first of all, the question is asked, which will one die faster from slitting their wrists or throats? What do you think?
Throat. The jugular. If you get the jugular vein, you're going to be out pretty quick.
Yeah, basically, if you get the right place, the carotid artery on the neck, the person will become unconscious within seconds and will be dead within minutes, if that much. The arteries on the wrists are a lot smaller, so it'll take a lot longer for the. But if you want to be really efficient, then the way to get someone is to slice their femoral artery in the groin area. That'll get you also. And basically the idea is that because of the carotid artery, that's where a lot of the blood flows through the body, going up to supply blood to the brain, So that's why that area, basically you bleed to death. That's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I saw when I was doing research on this is that in movies and TV shows, there is a death trope that the classic way to kill somebody is basically just taking a knife and or a razor or some other edge weapon and just slice it across someone's throat. All right. So I was able to find a list of 125 different movies that have scenes showing, where someone gets their throat sliced. Obviously, I'm not going to go through this entire list, but I just wanted to mention a few of them that are more popular that people would know about. So you have Avengers Endgame, when Hawkeye slices the throat of the Yakuza boss in the duel.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Braveheart.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously. The main scene, where Murren gets her throat cut by the magistrate, and that causes basically everything to happen there.
But William Wallace does the exact same thing back to the guy who did it to her.
That is correct.
So we get double throat slices.
That is true. That is true. Conan the Barbarian with Schwarzenegger. Along with the sequel, Conan the Destroyer, which I loved as a kid, but when I rewatched it recently, it looked so stupid.
Yeah.
For Your Eyes Only, Bond movie, where Bond's ally Ferrara gets his throat slit, while they're at the ice rink.
Oh, right.
Okay, just about every Friday the 13th movie.
Yes, every slasher movie.
That's right. They have a statistic here that says if you're in a Friday the 13th film, there's a 75% chance that you're going to get your throat slit. That's how you're going to die.
I'm glad somebody came down with that the statistical analysis.
Statistic. That's right. Same goes for the Halloween series. Just about everyone happens to. Highlander.
Well,
Kurgan gets his throat cut.
Right.
Hunger Games, Catching Fire. We have another one of those there. Obviously, Inglourious Basterds.
Mm-hmm.
Which Tarantino likes to do those things. You have John Wick Chapter 2, Kick-Ass. That's how Big Daddy kills one of the mooks in the warehouse. Again, there's just so many here on this list. You have Kong Skull Island, where Kong actually does that to the skull crawler.
Yeah.
Yeah. LA Confidential.
Mm-hmm.
What else do we got here? Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest.
I gotta imagine that even this list is not the full list of every movie that's ever used this technique.
Oh, I'm sure it's not. I'm sure. Again, I'm just jumping. I'm jumping around just to the ones that are more recognizable. You obviously have RoboCop. That's another big one that deals with that. Obviously Sweeney Todd. but that's with a straight razor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. V for Vendetta. The Wild Bunch, which I actually just watched yesterday. That's how Angel is killed at the end. And obviously on this list, they have Die Hard 2.
Hmm.
And Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Right.
That's how they killed the security guard. Yeah, we'll get there in two seasons. We'll talk about that. SWAT from 2003. Is another one on the list. A movie that I know that you're a big fan of is The Thing.
Yep.
Thing has one also there. I think we've gone through enough. I don't think I need to go through. There's a Harry Potter on this list. Which Harry Potter? I know you're a big Harry Potter fan. Which one has someone getting their throat slit?
Their throat slit?
Yes.
Nothing's really coming to mind. I know.
In the movie,
right.
In the movie, according to those lists, I'm trying to remember, how it actually happened in the movie. They write here that's how Snape was killed.
I know
that Voldemort does this to Snape with his wand.
Right. Okay. Yeah. He does it. Right. And then just to immobilize him, and then Nagini, his
Snape, that's right,
hits him multiple times in the face with venom. So correct, that's technically what kills him. Well, leads to his death is Nagini. But yeah, you're right.
Right. So yeah, that's
Deathly basically Hallowed the part two.
That is right. The final movie in the entire series. I also saw something very interesting that there was a case in 2016 where three people got their throats slit by the string of a kite. This was an accidental death. Apparently the kite string was made from it had like glass shards in it. That's just like really weird.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of someone trying? You know that?
No.
You know that they
like you said that they would have glass shards in the string.
Yep. That's what this article talks about.
I can get where maybe if the string was somehow tangled in something, and you're riding, let's say, a motorcycle or a fast bike, and it's right at neck level, and it'd be just enough that twine in the forest can kind of maybe dig in and cut. But I'm trying to imagine the wow. Okay, I never had kite string that had glass in it.
They have glass coated strings that they use for, you know, in competitions to try and cut other people's kite strings.
Oh. And really?
Yes.
All right, I'm this many years.
That sounds like something. That sounds like something in. That's right. That sounds like something they would have in like a James Bond type movie.
Right.
You know that James Bond has kite string that can slice through people or something like that.
Right. Odd Job and his wife popping kite.
That's right. So yeah, basically Telford is dead. It's nice that they they're all wearing white and that no one gets any blood on them except for Telford. Mm-hmm. They do a nice job of that because putting that in the wash will be a real bitch.
You know what's crazy is this movie, I think more than one or three, is much more graphic with some of the things that we have in the way people are being killed and some of the deaths. It's not just shooting. It's not just a grenade going off or a fire. I mean, we're seeing some fairly gruesome deaths in Die Hard 2.
Correct. And I think it has to do with Rennie Harlan, because Rennie Harlan on the commentary talks about the fact of how much he fought to get realistic violence into the movie. Because he said this is the type of thing these characters would do. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, even that, you know, the studio back when the plane crashes, the studio wanted it to be a cargo plane that didn't have any passengers on it. And he said, no, you have to have passengers in it. And what they decided to do was show it to like a focus group. And the focus group were completely shocked when they took down a real plane, you know, filled with passengers. And they're like, okay, this is where we're going to keep it. Mm-hmm. You know, no one's going to care if it's a cargo plane.
This movie, of all of them, it's almost because it's so gritty with the way they treat the first plane crash, the death scenes, it almost pulls it just a little away from the rest of that, quote, the comedy part of these movies that we kind of like. We kind of like the fact that it's an action movie. It's got funny lines. It's got great set pieces. This one almost pulls it away, and you go, it's almost too gritty. It's almost too heavy.
Right.
I mean, the first one, obviously, you're holding hostage at Christmas, but you don't have people having like ice, you know, cube or icicles thrown through their eyes and throats being slit and being put through compressors and on conveyor belts.
Well, it depends on where you spend Christmas.
Well, you're true. And I know the third one, there is a scene like this, but it's almost kind of in the dark in an elevator, so you don't notice it as much.
Correct.
But this one is very. Yeah, you have those moments of like, wow, for a moment, it went from fun movie to, oh, this is really, really heavy, you know?
That's right. And it works because it adds to, you know, the whole idea of this scene, and we're going to get to more scenes later this week, is to basically throw the the audience off balance.
Mm-hmm. No,
you know, you
I don't
think that something's happening and it's not.
I don't want anyone to hear my comment as if somehow I don't like this movie. I think it's a great diehard movie. I think the first three for me just make a perfect trilogy. I don't need to see any other diehard movies. I kind of wish there weren't any other diehard movies. This one is definitely the middle movie and it's the darker of the three.
You know, the audience is completely in shock as to what's going on. And, you know, our minds must be racing, trying to figure out, you know, when you're watching this for the first time, what is going on? You know, he just slit Telford's throat. And then the next thing he does is he reaches into his pocket and pulls out a walkie-talkie, which is very similar to the ones that we've seen throughout the rest of this movie. He punches in a code and then he says, Eagle's Nest is actually on schedule and in position. And I mean, first of all, I love the choice to call them the hatchling, you know, because like if you look at, I looked up what hatchling is. A hatchling, you know, they give me all these biological explanations as what a hatchling is. But the idea of a hatchling is it's something that is newly created. You know, it's something that's mm-hmm. either in a cocoon or it's in an egg and it just comes right out. And that's perfect, exactly what's going on here. You know, these guys are all dressed in white and they're, you know, so you can call them in, maybe they're eggs, and now they've hatched and they're, you know, now we can see who they really are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I love that analogy.
Yeah, I think your brain is trying to play catch up while we're watching this of like what has just happened. And you get I think all of a sudden, and depending how quick you are, how many of the movies you've seen up to this point, I know when I saw it in the theater, my first thought is, these guys aren't bad guys, are they? I must be mis- something has to there's gonna be an explanation because you know, John Amos is not a bad guy.
Like, no,
I only
not.
Think of him as like a couple of movies that I know, and I'm like, he's not a bad guy. These aren't bad guys, these guys were brought in to take out the bad guys.
Come on, this is JJ's father.
Right, exactly. Dynamite. I mean, come on.
That's right.
But I mean, seriously, I love this from a story crafting perspective. They never told you they were the good guys. You just assumed. And they dress them in white. You're out in the snow. You're like, well, of course. These guys are military. They've been brought in to bring in this ex guy with all of his forces. Never in a million years did it cross my mind that they were part of the overall master plan.
Yeah. And they do it so well. You know, they really do a nice job of completely shocking us as to what's going on.
Mm-hmm. It's so well done that here we are. Like I said, I've seen this movie 100 times easily. And I still have that sense that you've manipulated me emotionally. You've done such a good job. Even when I know it's coming, I'm still shocked by it.
Right. Right. That definitely makes sense, the way that they would do that. You know, and then we hear the response. And first of all, he looks at his watch, you know, to make sure, I guess, that he's on schedule with that type of thing. And then we hear Stewart's response, where he goes, Roger Hatchling, we are secure here. You have a green light. You know, and what's great, and we'll talk a lot about this over the next week or two. But did you notice how many people are on the ground crew are running around in the back?
When the camera kind of, after we get past our a drug lord kingpin that's kind of sitting there, and then.
That's right.
You've got people working on the plane. Yeah. It looks like they're all gearing it up, getting ready for takeoff.
Correct. But didn't they, I mean, first of all, of the terrorists, there are four that are left. Okay. You have Miller. You have, I think Khan. And then you have Esperanza and Stewart. That's it. So who are all these guys?
I don't know. Are they leftovers from the plane itself?
Well, theoretically, they shouldn't be. I mean, yeah. So he said it last week. And then, you know, we see the shot of them. And these guys are all there. I mean, we're going to see a lot of them over the next few weeks, which is just it just always makes me crack up because these guys shouldn't be there. You know, they just happen to be there. And, you know, we get a shot, as you said, we get a shot of Esperanza in the cargo hold. And we also get a shot of Miller standing guard But once again, you can see the red tape on his ammunition clips, which is a nice little touch. You know that they're very good consistently in this movie by having the characters with either red or blue. And we'll talk about that later in the week, what the significance of that really is. So he goes, do you have a green light? I repeat, a green light. So the obvious answer to having a green light is, a traffic light. Red means stop, green means go, and I guess yellow means step on the pedal or whatever it is. Be cautious, be cautious as you step on the pedal or something like that. But I actually looked up to see if there are any other connotations for the term green light. Are you familiar with any others?
Well, and obviously it's similar to the traffic light, but in when you're jumping out of a plane, when you're getting ready to jump, they'll put the red light on. Plus, you get less visibility, so if there's no light coming out that an enemy could see you as you're approaching. And as you get to the jump point, it'll go to green light to let you know we're over the target.
Okay, all right. That's also the same type of connotation as you have a green light. The green light is now it's time to go. That type of thing. So there's actually a surface to air missile that is known as a green light missile. It's the precursor to the SeaCat. So I just thought it was very interesting that the name of a missile is a green light. And then when you deal with when you're talking about UFOs, so a green light is the same term as a green fireball. Which there are certain types of UFOs that basically what they basically say is that the green fireballs are artificial extraterrestrial origin. That's the idea of that. Then you also have there's a name of a company called Greenlight Collectibles, which is located in Indiana. And then my favorite one here is, do you know that a green light is a baseball term? Have you ever heard of
No.
where a manager gives a batter or a runner a green light?
Oh, to run on the hit. Yeah.
It gives the permission. It's permission for the manager for a batter or runner to get aggressive. Meaning you can swing away on the 3-0 count or you want the runner to steal a base, as you just mentioned. The Detroit Tigers manager Jim Leland was known for this, and there's even a time when he was supposed to tell one of his players to bunt, and instead he gave him a green light, and he ended up hitting a 3-run homer in order to win the game 3-2. So,
whoops, happy accident.
Yes.
Yeah, generally. You hear the term green light means your plan is good to go. We're going to go with it. It's generally an affirmative. It's almost always a positive thing. You've got the green light.
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, it can even be like, hey, are we going to make this movie? Yep. Studio just gave us the green light. We're moving
That's
forward.
Right. Mm-hmm. For sure. For sure. And then the shot changes. And for the last 5 seconds of this minute, we actually will once again hear the opening theme of this show. We will hear Old Cape Cod being whistled by Marvin as he's arranging his records. it's a great little touch, that he still is whistling that tune that John heard all those months ago. And then he like turns around and we see some figure standing at the or almost toppling over at the top of a little ladder. But people are gonna have to come back tomorrow to find out who that is. And who's interrupting Marvin again?
Who could it be?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's Stewart and his men. Maybe they threw Telfer down. I don't know. Could be. All right. You have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
No. I'm good. I'm really happy we got a chance to let me relive that moment of shock and awe, use a military phrase. With this minute, because it's still one of those that I'll never forget in the theater. And every time I watch it, I'm transported back to my first watching. Very few movies do that for me. Exorcist does that for me. Jaws does that for me. Star Wars. This is one of those movies that it's such an indelible impression. It's cemented into my mind. So it's a nice thing to be able to do that. Because usually once you've seen a movie, there's no more shock. And yet for a movie to still be able to do that and let you relive sort of that visceral reaction to it, To me, that says something about the power of that scene and the fact that they fooled us for so long that it just messes with your head when they pull the rug out from under you.
That's right. That's right. And they do that really well here. So the script doesn't have that many differences here, but the line at the beginning starts with someone saying, "I was in Grenada." And then everyone laughs. It says, "The bitter laughter of the battlefield." And then Grant says, "Grenada, 5 minutes of firefight, 5 weeks of surfing." Laughter, which subsides a bit as Grant looks at his watch. It looked duplicated by the others. Telford is oblivious to all this, and he's wistful. "I wish I was with you guys for that." "So do we, kid." Telford is touched. "Really, sir?" "Yeah, then we wouldn't have to do this." And in a flash, Grant draws his combat knife and slits the kid's throat. Telford flops back off the bench. Grant is already digging into the cargo pocket of his trousers, and he comes out with a transceiver, the same distinctive scramble transceiver used by Stewart's men. And then into the transceiver, he says, "Eagle's Nest, this is Hatchling, on schedule and in place." And then a shot of the hangar. Stewart holds his transceiver while he looks up at the plane prepared for him. One of his men comes out, gives him the thumbs up sign. Stewart, into transceiver. "Roger, Hatchling, we are secure here. You have a green light. Repeat, green light." And then it says, cut to Marvin, whistling, stacking dolls, shoes, more flotsam from the airport. See, he's scavenged. At a sound, he turns. So
pretty close.
Yeah. They do a nice job of taking what's on the paper and showing it to us. You know, I like how they did it here, and they didn't change that much, and you know, meaning that it worked. So normally on Mondays we do McClain Monday, but since Alan has already given us his top five, and everyone's gonna have to wait for mine till the finale show, so I decided that what I will do is Alan and I this week will give some more off the beaten track stories about airplanes, airports, stuff like that. So today Alan's gonna give us another story. Some sort of anecdote, adventure, misadventure story, something that's happened to him over the course of his life that is somehow related to air travel. So, Alan, what story you got for us?
This one's quick, and it's not really heavy or anything, but it's just something that I remember in that whole dawn of everybody having a cell phone. Instead of moving, because when I first got into IT, we had pagers. My dad had a bag phone. I mean, my whole family has had, at least my mom and dad had cell phones in their car when they were new. They loved the idea that they had one finally. I had one that I kind of played with, but when I had my first IT support job, we had two-way pagers. The company thought it was cheaper that you could just get a pager and send a message through your – it was literally two-way. It was like sending a text through your pager. But then all of a sudden they said, well, maybe at this point we should get phones for everybody because sometimes a phone's going to be better if you're traveling. And so this was still fairly new. So this is a little while ago. And we had a plane that was diverted because of bad weather. And, of course, every person on this flight, it was a business flight. Everybody's in business suits, business attire. They're all like, okay, crap, we've got to run to the desk to try to figure out what and try to get in line for the travel people to get me a new connecting flight or a new flight, you know, your typical what you would have done 25, 30 years ago. And I thought to myself, like, oh, wait a minute, I've got a phone. I just had written down the travel number for the business that was associated with booking our flights for us as IT people. So we're waiting to get out of the plane because I'm in the back of the plane. I'm not getting anywhere close to the front. Everyone's scrambling. They're trying to figure out how to get over one another because everyone knows you got to get to the desk. Whoever's going to be first is going to get helped. And if you're late and you're trying to find a new connector, you're trying to get home, I just get on the phone and I'm like, hey, hi. Yeah, my plane just got diverted to X airport. I can't remember. I think it was Chicago. I'm supposed to be going to Atlanta. So obviously I'm going to need a different flight. Can you see what's available? And so while everyone's scrambling to go do it manually because we're at that age where cell phones were just starting to be where everyone would get one, here I am on the phone on the plane. I walk out of the plane, go past the desk because I've already got my arrangement. I go straight to the next gate. They're like, yep, we've got your information transferred here. And this was all pre-all 9/11, pre-all that crap. And just walked to gate and got on my next flight that was going to come and get me home. And wow. I just never forget about everyone was doing this manually still. We were in that mode where so many people knew they had to rush to the counter to go talk to somebody on a computer to find a connecting flight or find something and try to see if there was room. And I went through the 800 number travel agency. They're using the same systems, log in, get me a connector, book my seat, lock it down, and I just have to go straight to the gate. It was great. And I'm like, this is the coolest thing in the world. I bypassed all of the crap that all these people are having to deal with. So it's today people listen to that story and go, yeah, what's the big deal? I just went onto an app and did it myself. But for me, that was a big moment when I realized how technology has really started to change everything.
Yeah, seriously. You know who you reminded me of while you're telling the story? You sound like Del Griffith. That's something that Del would do.
Well, I'm of the age. But it's those stories that you look back and go, is it better today? Or, you know, I don't know. There was just something more, I don't know, visceral about having to fight for like that next spot on the plane. And everything now is an app. Everything is, it's just at the touch of your fingers, which is great. I love that. But then it's like, it's almost too easy now. And then we complain if we don't have a Wi-Fi, and we complain if we don't instantaneously connect because we've got to, you know, share bandwidth because we're like in a stadium with thousands of people all trying to use your phones at once. It's interesting how we've evolved.
That's right. Or if like your power goes out or something goes on with the computer, you're like, you panic and you're like, oh, mm-hmm. How am I going to get back online? You know, that type of thing.
Right. Right. I mean, we're so interconnected and so online all the time. I mean, think about it. Everything, even our televisions now, I stream everything. I don't have a cable.
That's right.
I stream. So, you know, maybe that's why. And side note, you know me, I love camping. I love being outdoors. Maybe that unplugging every now and then is such a good thing to put into your life, because my wife and I love the idea when we go kayaking, when we go camping, when we go hiking. It's whether it's a couple hours or a couple of days, we're kind of unplugged from all of the high Wi-Fi stuff and getting replugged into like the important things like nature and earth and being outside and smelling fresh air.
That's true. Well, as you know, I unplug once a week for 24 hours.
24 hours is
25, like 25 weeks. Hours, 25 hours,
25. But still, but I gave you a reference to a movie when I said that.
Yes, I know that.
24 hours is like 3 weeks.
I right now I can't make the connection. I've heard it, but you know, my mind is not going there.
I'll give you the following line and you will know exactly now where that comes from.
Okay.
Are you going to close the beaches?
Oh, okay. Obviously. Jaws. Yes.
Only 24 hours, and here someone goes, 24 hours is like 3 weeks. It's like, okay, well, then go out there and go get eaten by the shark. I don't care. Go ahead. Go for it. There. You can't wait 24 hours. Go on. Help yourself. Anyway, sorry. Didn't mean to sidetrack us.
No, that's okay. We always get sidetracked. It's fun. Yeah. All right. Well, Alan, you want to tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, if you want to go and check out a couple of the movies me and my buddy Walt did in the Gene Wilder same vein of these movies by minutes, we did Young Frankenstein season one. We did Blazing Saddles season two. It's called The Wilder Ride. We changed it to a talk show for a while. And then, as Rob alluded to, it's been kind of on permanent hiatus. My buddy Walt had lost his mom and then within a few months got divorced. And then somehow a few months later reconnected with an old girlfriend from high school who had just been divorced. Started hanging out with her, got remarried, and he's been on a now 2-year honeymoon. So at some point when that comes down, maybe we'll get back to doing some shows. But you can still go out and get all the old content. Just look for The Wilder Ride, or you can visit the website wilderride.com.
Or they can just find you here, you know, a few times this season.
Rock has adopted me. He's like, I feel bad. You don't get to do shows anymore. Come on in.
No, I do. It's not being done out of pity. It's being done. It's being done because I enjoy talking with you about movies. That's what it comes down to.
I appreciate it because it's a great outlet to have. I think I've said that before. Do a political talk show for those folks who are interested in what's going on news talk wise. That one can get people their blood pressure up depending on where you stand on things, but I do that every day. You can find that, just do a Google search for The Alan Sanders Show.
All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rap Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on what used to be known as Twitter, but now it's X. I'm still going to keep calling it Twitter. I don't know. Or you can find me on my website, movierapminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and there,